You're listening to WRIR 97.3 LPFM, and this is Open Source RVA. Today on Open Source RVA, we hear from Tim Miller with Richmond 2015, Delegate Jen McClellan, and Michael Gilbert, co-founder of Ride Richmond, about unsuccessful efforts to improve bike safety laws during this year's General Assembly session. And Rick Tatnall talks about the uncertain future of Shaco Bottom, a place he says may be the most historic site in America. And he discusses his latest team effort with three fellow Richmond activists, the Richmond Open Government Project. But first, here are some of the top headlines making news right now.
For Open Source RVA, I'm Amy Daniel, and here's the news. The next step in the plan to bring the Redskins training camp to Richmond is a community meeting hosted by the City of Richmond next Tuesday, March 5th, which will take place at 5:30 p.m. in the Barbara Tallheimer Theater at the Science Museum of Virginia. The meeting is meant to be a follow-up about the proposed public park area on Lee Street just behind the Science Museum. A media advisory released by the city on Tuesday announced the meeting and went on to explain that Richmond's Economic Development Authority is now developing the site to host the summer training camp for the Washington Redskins and for Bon Secours medical offices. The final design for the area will be presented at Tuesday, March 5th's meeting, which is said to include modifications based on public input. City Clerk Alvin M. Anderson has been removed from his $100,000 a year post after only 8 months, according to a report in Thursday's Richmond Free Press. The unbylined Free Press article cites two council sources who say that Anderson was let go and placed on paid leave February 20th for his mismanagement of the city clerk's office. But there has been no official announcement of this decision. City Council President Charles Samuels had no comment when asked about the city clerk's status. Anderson, a 30-year city employee who formerly worked as a budget analyst and personnel administrator, reportedly has 3 weeks to find a new position with the city. He was hired in June of last year to replace Lou Brown Ali, who is now City Council's chief of staff. The Richmond International Film Festival is already underway at the Bird Theater in Carytown and will continue through Sunday. The four-day festival of more than 45 short films from around the world will also include industry seminars, director Q&As, and workshops, as well as a film competition with more than 20,000 in prizes. Among the many acclaimed short films to be screened are a movie about local St. Benedict's Catholic School students called The Youth Roundtable Project, and a special documentary on Washington's legendary Bayou Music Club. For ticket information and screening times, go to themixshorts.com.
Before you can take action, you must first have a plan, a detailed roadmap and compass that can take you where you need to go. Rick Tatnall has a lot of plans for the region, plans for tourism, for peace, for smart growth, for community engagement, and for government accountability. The founder of Replenish Richmond believes that city residents, like all Americans, have abdicated their community responsibilities by failing to act on opportunities and the power of common unity. Tatnall has been called a cheerleader for Richmond, and he briefly ran for mayor against Dwight Jones last year. His website at replenishrichmond.com outlines a series of initiatives to improve the region, from an East End action plan to a Richmond's of the World proposal. Tatnall's no blind booster, though. He's bumped heads with city officials on numerous occasions, and he's recently signed on as one of the sponsors of the Open Government Project, which seeks to make City Hall more transparent. Rick Tatnall joins us now on Open Source RVA. Hello.
Thanks for having me, Don.
Tell us a little of your background. You're originally from Pennsylvania?
I was born and raised in Philadelphia. Went to UVA in 1975, graduated in 79, moved to the Richmond area in 1980, and been living in the city since 1987.
Wow. What were your immediate impressions of Richmond when you first got here? What was the first
time? Well, I'm got married, moved into Short Pump when it was actually just a lot of trees and, mm-hmm. And no houses and right. certainly nothing living on Spinning Wheel Way in one of the new subdivisions out uh-huh. there. And I could never have imagined what it has become now. Right. But I didn't really understand or get much into the city at that point. And it wasn't until I moved into the city that I really had an awakening, both from an advocacy standpoint and certainly from just the urban living of living in mm-hmm. living near it was Betty's. There was Betty's, and then there was not Betty's. Well, I was there when it was Betty's, and it was a biker bar and gunshots every once in a while, and it was a lot different from Spinning Wheel Way, I guess.
Right. What year would this have been?
This 1987.
Okay.
And that was really the start of my advocacy. So I just last year had my quarter century anniversary, I guess, for being involved in the Richmond community, and proud to be doing it.
Well, was that when you founded the organization Citizens Against Crime?
Oh, no. And actually, I didn't found that. Lisa Raisin is the mm-hmm. founder of Citizens Against Crime. But in 2003, I joined her and became her executive director, if you will, for about 6 years. And that was a very powerful experience mm-hmm. and really introduced me to a lot of Richmond that I never would have had the opportunity to experience, and certainly in the way that I did and being with Alicia so much. Mm-hmm. But that was 2003 on that one.
What did get you involved? What was the issue or the topic that engaged you to start getting involved in the city community?
Well, I back in the late 80s, I knew a lot of people in the entertainment business, musicians and others, and I started an organization called Music for Miracles, and we did events to raise money for local nonprofits, for primarily for Children's Miracle Network is where the Music for Miracles came about. And I got good at doing events, and I realized after I did some and had to figure out how to close streets and get this permit and do that with the police that it would be a lot easier to do the next one. And so I just kept on doing it, and probably through the 90s it was more of a hit-and-miss advocacy. I was doing a lot of things, helping a lot of people, but not really with a plan. Mm-hmm. And then in 1999, I took a trip with kids to Richmond upon Thames, our sister city in London.
This is the Richmonds around the
world.
This
kind of got the start of the Richmonds of the World concept. But it was my first trip abroad, and we had students from all the 9 Richmond high schools. Mm-hmm. Most of them had never been on a plane before, certainly let alone been out of the country. And it was a very powerful experience for me and for the kids. And when I got back, I realized that this advocacy thing, it was nice to do it here and there, but that I really wanted to do it forever. Mm-hmm. And as a planner, and I appreciate you noting that, because strategic planning is something that I think is critical and that I'm very good at. Mm-hmm. I came up with a plan, and it was a personal mission, and I've been following it ever since. And 13 years of that has been of intentionality has been very powerful for me.
Mm-hmm. Talk about intentionality, because you go into that a little bit on your website, and why is that so important?
Well, it's somewhat of a confidence thing. Strategic planning means that you define the plan all the way through to the end, and you think it through, and you make sure that still at 75% through the plan that you mm-hmm. have a realistic pathway. And that doesn't mean it's going to happen that way, because it never does.
Well, Richmond seems to be a place that loves to commission plans and proposals, but then never follows through on them.
There's never a strategic plan. We're good at talking about problems, but if you want to look at whatever the commissions that have done, all the studies that have done, there's no planning to them. There's just definition of the problems.
Mm-hmm. Well, what about, say, the downtown plan, which I thought was really kind of a landmark for this area as far as getting people involved.
The downtown master plan is an important part of my efforts, and it's something that I want to follow. But what I'm trying to do is to do what the downtown master plan didn't do, mm-hmm. which is create a literal pathway of where do you go from here, and that not just that you want to change this streetscape and make this more appealing and put this tree here, but you're going to do it. When are you going to do it? Where's the money going to come from? Who's going to mm-hmm. plant it? Who's going to water it all the way through? That's what strategic planning is. And again, it doesn't mean that it's going to happen in that pathway. But the whole part of planning is defining what you think is going to happen, and more importantly, why you think it's going to happen. Mm-hmm. So when it doesn't, good or bad, you learn and you keep going.
Yeah.
It's about its destinations, Don. It's about defining where you want to go and then getting there. And I think that's our real issue in Richmond is that we don't have any destinations.
Well, you've been a real outspoken advocate for tourism and how Richmond markets itself to the outside world. Speak to that a little bit. What are we doing right and what are we doing wrong?
The thing that we're doing right is that we've been amazing at creating history. One of my promotions is that I think that quite literally Richmond is the most influential and historic community in America. And I was born and raised in Philadelphia, and Philadelphia doesn't hold a candle to this town in terms of the definition of historic is having influence on history. Mm-hmm. And I think when you want to look at what has happened, including slavery, very influential, not something that we want to be proud of, and we're not proud of it, but it happened, and the influence on the development of the United States of America you just can't compare it. Right. And we've had those things up and down, including the great things like religious freedom and from 1607 on. So I think that that's a critical part of what we do right is that we continue to make history here. The problem is that we don't talk about it. We're not proud of it yet. And that pride is an important thing that I want to try to promote. But we also don't recognize the economic power that tourism has. And I think that's not the driving force for me, but it's a thing that's the change agent. We need money in this town. We need money in this region. Those meals taxes that would have been being paid by Chesterfieldians and Henricoans hopefully would be paid if we had a really strong tourism market would be paid by people from Philadelphia and Detroit and Des Moines and whatever, and not from those people from the counties. We need to tap into that, and that's the thing we're not doing in this town.
Well, talk a little bit about Replenish Richmond and what is different than a regular sort of booster group? What's different here?
Well, I guess Replenish Richmond is my final incarnation of a lot of names, and we've talked about some of them throughout this. I think throughout all of my advocacy, the one thing that I've been trying to do is to get people to realize that they both need to and want to be more involved in their community. I do believe that Americans and Richmonders have abdicated their responsibility for citizenship, and I believe that it's both a moral—
Let's get into that a little bit. What exactly do you mean? We're not paying attention, or we don't take it seriously?
We're not doing things. I think that we, both nationally and locally, have said, okay, you elected officials, it's your job to fix our problems for us. And not only are they not capable of doing it, the government wasn't set up to do it that way. And now with the financial crisis that we're dealing with, the money isn't there either. And all this time, years and years and years, where people have said, okay, I'm going to pay my taxes and I'm going to vote, but it's up to you guys to do the problem solving. Well, that's not working anymore.
Well, Richmond also has kind of a patriarchal sort of a atmosphere where we think that the business community is going to make our decisions for us, too. What do you think that their role should be in all this?
Well, I think their role is to help us create the business plan that we don't have for this community. If I, you know, that's something that I feel is critically important. We, both as a city and when I was running as mayor, if I had continued, it would have been to get this town to run like a city that is a business. And not saying, you know, that everything is a business-oriented process, but you have to look at all aspects. You can't talk about the good things without talking about the bad things.
Well, do you have satisfied customers is one question.
Well, that certainly is something that we would maybe struggle with in this town.
Well, you kind of bumped heads with Peter Chapman, the city's economic director, over the city's handling of the Civil War's 150th anniversary. What was the problem as you saw it?
Well, I think my bumping heads with Mr. Chapman wasn't necessarily about any one issue. I think my problems with that department and how it's leading the city is that we aren't doing anything to capture the opportunities that are inherent in the sesquicentennial and in the upcoming 2015 bike championships. We still have three more years, so it's not done yet. But if you want to look at what we've done to date, I don't see where the city's taking advantage of any opportunities during this time frame. And there isn't a plan that has been articulated to anyone that we can all get excited about and, more importantly, be a part of. If citizens aren't able to participate because they don't know what's going on, which is very difficult, City Hall doesn't tell you what they're doing and when some if they all of a sudden just unveil it. Oh, by the way, we're going to be doing this.
Yeah.
Well, it's a team effort, and that department is not playing like a team.
Well, yeah, I wanted to get into the sort of the open government project that you're one of the sponsors of.
Right. We've actually the formal name now is Better Government for Richmond.
Okay.
And we're creating this new organization that is an outgrowth of our open government petition and project that we started last August.
Mm-hmm.
And we have been successful in getting council to start to have a summary of discussion in the minutes, and that's an important.
Yeah, because I was going to ask you if you could name like one or two things that council that could do tomorrow that wouldn't cost a lot of money that would sort of alleviate the problem.
Well, we've actually named about 100 things, mm-hmm. quite literally, that they.
Yeah, we had C. Wayne Taylor up here.
Well,
City Hall
and
Review.
Mr. Taylor has helped to define those and to compare and what other other localities are doing.
Mm-hmm.
These are things that can be done without a lot of money expenditure, without a lot of time expenditure, without a lot of hassle.
Mm-hmm.
They either haven't just been known to be needed to be done, and we haven't had an organization like us to push on it.
Mm-hmm. Talking about things like putting council meetings online, better
archiving them 2 years from now. Thank God for Silver Persinger, or we wouldn't be able to have all those different things available.
Right.
And he's
been doing them on his own.
Right.
Yeah.
And, you know, and again, it's 2013, so technology makes it a lot easier mm-hmm. for us to be able to do this. And it's just, this is another thing, and I guess it fits into my advocacy and what I'm trying to do in general is that people can't get involved in the government and the actions of what's going on in their community if they're not aware and if they don't have access to information.
Mm-hmm.
And there's nothing to hide. I don't think that City Hall is trying to hide things, but they haven't made it easy to get to, and they don't actively try to make it available.
No, but it's a system that can be gamed to keep information at a very minimal level.
Yeah, we've got two aspects that we're dealing with here. One is City Council, which is much more of a defined process, and our efforts will be much quickly successful there because it is legally bound.
Mm-hmm,
When you start getting into the mayor's administration and you talk about working papers and some of the things that are used to keep the information from coming out,
right.
That's where it gets a little more sticky. And what I'm hoping is that there's a general understanding that citizens want this information and that the mayor and the administration and Mr. Chapman and all the different people that are part of this process will realize that it's in their best interest to give up this information and not hold it close to the vest because they're going to get more information and benefits from the community from their ability to be involved.
Mm-hmm. Well, let's stay on citizen apathy for a little bit. How do you engage people?
It's hard, boy. I'll tell you, in today's world, there's just so many different things that are engaging people away from being involved in the community. And mm-hmm. I think that the thing that I've realized is that you have to hit them where they live. You have to get them excited in their heart before they'll get their mind engaged.
Mm-hmm.
And the thing with getting involved in the community is that there are lots of ways to do it. And sometimes people get caught up in that it has to be go build a Habitat house or put cans on the shelves at Feedmore
right.
or go down to Conrad Center or whatever. And those are great things, and we need them to be done. But just doing a potluck supper for the neighbors in your community so that everybody gets to know each other and know who their next-door neighbor mm-hmm. is, that's critically important to building community.
Just basic stuff.
Just basic stuff. It doesn't – you know, we've kind of come up to this volunteer. I've changed the what you say instead of community service because community service has become sort of a penal you're either in school and you got to do community service
working on
to
the side
to graduated,
of the road.
Or you did something wrong and you got to do community service to get out of the way,
yeah.
Chris Brown. I call it service to community now.
Mm-hmm.
And service to community can be any number of different things. And it can be something that you like and it can be something that you're really good at, but it just has to be selfless.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And I think that once people start to see what happens when they give to the community, when you give, you get.
Mm-hmm.
You get back psychically and physically and emotionally and intellectually. And it's up to the giver to decide how they interpret the get. But they'll get stuff. And
right.
hopefully, if we can just incrementally get people to be a little more involved, then the next time, hopefully, it'll happen quicker and then a little mm-hmm. quicker. And then they start to do it just because instead of
right
because they have to.
Because they have to, right. Well, I guess so. We should end with Shaco. You're not only a cheerleader for Richmond, but you seem to have a lot of ideas and plans and initiatives for Shaco. Can you outline some of the ideas you've had for that area?
Well, it's I consider Shaco to be the epicenter of America. I think that's where Richmond started. It's where the things that have happened in the Commonwealth have been the most powerful. Mm-hmm. I think that you can really take the whole creation and development of the United States of America and sort mm-hmm. of boil it down back to what's happening in Shaco.
Well, you have your, I think it's the Stone Farm project?
Oh, we have the Stone Dam Partnership.
Stone Dam Partnership.
And that's hopefully my way of getting people to be more involved in the community in sort of a collaborative fashion under mm-hmm. the Stone Dam Partnership idea.
And that's aimed at businesses?
It's aimed at individuals and businesses. It's anybody can be a partner, and mm-hmm. groups of people, families. I'm trying to get people to do a resolution for Richmond, and I want to help them do that. Mm-hmm. But the Stone Dam comes from the word Shaco. And
right,
Jeff
right,
Ruggles okay. Determined that through his investigations academically that the natives considered Shaco to be a stone dam, not the where the creek came in or mm-hmm. whatever. And that's what they did at the Falls of the James, and that's how they caught fish. And the English settlers used those dams for a long time after that, and that's really where the word came from. And I'm trying to honor the word of Shaco, which is sort of a connector between the Native American community and thousands of years of people being here before the English settlers, quote, discovered Richmond.
Right.
This has been a special place for a long time.
Well, I'm Don Harrison, and I've been speaking with Rick Tatnall. He's the president and founder of Replenish Richmond. For more information on the organization, you can log on to replenishrichmond.com. And to learn more about the Better Government Project, that's the
Better
name of it.
Better Government Richmond.
Yeah, go to cityhallreview.com. Thanks, Rick, for joining us.
Thank you, Don.
The circumstances that you cannot go out. Ooh,
I'm Paul Goldman, and you're not, so up yours. Up your donation to WRIR. Richmond needs this radio station, and WRIR needs you. If you've never donated before, that's fine. Listeners are WRIR's main source of funding. That means you. I have always been, and we hope it always will be. So I respectively say, up yours.
Push me off to start the fun on a bike ride to the moon. Lots of room for everyone on a bike ride to the moon.
Bicycling is a healthy, eco-friendly, and increasingly popular way for Richmonders to get around. Over the past 4 years, the city has taken great pains to show its bike friendliness, installing new signage and bike lanes, and where bike lanes aren't practical, sharrows, hybrid lanes that put a premium on cyclist awareness. As the city prepares to host the 2015 UCI Road World Championships, the Virginia General Assembly took its first crack at getting in on the two-wheel act, taking up three significant measures to improve cyclist safety. But the training wheels never quite came off. All three bills likely will return in future sessions, but until then, cyclists remain, in many respects, second-class citizens on the state's roads. I'm with Tim Miller. He's the Chief Operating Officer with Richmond 2015. That's the UCI Road World Champions that's coming to Richmond in 2015, presumably. Also, Michael Gilbert, co-founder of Ride Richmond. He's a member of a group that actively lobbied the General Assembly during this last session that just ended. And, of course, Delegate Jen McClellan, who represents Richmond and exactly one precinct of Henrico County. Thank you guys for joining me.
Good to be here. Thank you.
Thanks for having us.
All right. And, of course, we're here to talk a little bit about these three bills that were very much aimed at making Richmond and Virginia's roads more bike-friendly.
And obviously in the context of this major road race coming to Richmond. So first of all, I guess let's start with the bills that were in the session this year that were proposed. Were one was to take care of, I guess, dooring, and just to briefly describe what dooring is where somebody's cycling and go ahead.
Certainly. So dooring is a phenomenon in the cycling community. Now, when you're riding, you know, far to the right, trying to share the lane, and basically a car door opens suddenly in front of you, and you have no time to react, so you collide with the door, and it's usually as a result of the driver of the motor vehicle who's opening the door not checking the lane to ensure it's clear.
And in YouTube videos, this has comedic effect, but in real life, it does not.
Yeah, it's interesting, actually, because Allstate Insurance a couple years ago put a dooring video up of a truck taking off a car door, and they branded it as accident forgiveness. Well, forgiveness implies fault, so it would seem to be the case, even by Allstate Insurance in this national ad, that if you open your car door, you're presumed to be at fault.
So now here's the thing. The kicker is, in Virginia right now, the cyclist is at fault. He's hit that stationary object. So how they describe it?
Well, yeah, it could be that there's either neither party is assigned fault, since no law exists to do so, or you know, if you damage someone's property and you know you're not determined otherwise, they can civilly come after you. You know, as kind of crazy as that sounds, you know,
so
you might have hit the door and damaged the
car
door, and you know it's not. They can still come after you. So, yeah.
All right. And then the second one is a bill that was dealing with following too close and a 3-foot passing zone, I guess.
That's correct. So right now in the code, basically, you know, kind of the tailgating or following too closely is really for a motor vehicle following another motor vehicle, semi-trailer or trailer, more closely than is reasonable and prudent. But that doesn't apply to cyclists who, you know, don't have the luxury of a 2,000-pound steel cage around them. And also the code currently has 2-foot passing is required by law, and we were hoping to get 3-foot this year as well.
And when you say 2-foot passing, that means?
Basically from the leftmost portion of the body that you're passing to have at least 2 feet of distance and space there.
So this kind of eliminates the fear of having this large 2,000-pound object right next to you while you're trying to ride.
Certainly, yeah, and there's, you know, especially when you have larger vehicles or semi-trucks and things like that passing you, you create a vacuum even when you pass, and they're quite big. So it's just safety, a safety issue for sure.
Now, these were both Senate bills. We also had House Bill 1810, which is a local bill, Delegate McQuinn, Dolores McQuinn, and this was a mask bill. This was, dates back to probably the turn of the century, has to do with people wearing masks in public. I think that this is, as I recall, there's some of this has to do with racial profiling and just, I guess, race relations, but now when you're talking a cyclist or a skier or not a bank robber, or unless he's going at high speed in a convertible, he might want to have a mask on so that he's not chapped by the time he gets where he's going.
Yeah, absolutely. And even, you know, we have in Virginia, a huge hunting population who hunt. Winter boaters down at Virginia Beach had contacted us and said, hey, you know, we do winter boating. We wear masks to protect ourselves as well. So, and the interesting thing about that law is that as it is now, it's not only a felony to wear a mask, but in order to do that, unless you're at, say, a masquerade ball is one exception. There's some other kind of antiquated exceptions there, but you actually have to have in writing permission from the owner, regardless if it's public or private property.
So the owner meaning if you're riding a bike on public property, the streets, there is nobody that you could get that kind of permission from, right?
Not that I'm aware of, so I'm
not. This is some random citizen ask him to sign your waiver or something.
Yeah.
So these were all pretty basic, but in many cases, very much safety-related bills. Common sense. So I guess moving to Delegate McClellan, what happened?
Well, each of these, or two of the bills, died in a committee on the House side, and I never actually got to see them. But from what talking to some of the members of the Transportation Committee, at least on dooring, the concern seemed to be one of whenever you create a new offense, whether it's a finable offense in this case, or something that could create liability, you want to be sure that everyone understands what the rules are and that it's not subjective at all. And there was some concern of, I think the bill, the Doering bill, said something of, you wait a reasonable amount of time to see if it's clear. And there were questions of, well, what is a reasonable amount of time? I think had the bill, and the bill went to the Transportation Committee, and they're not quite used to dealing with those issues. I think it might have been different if it had come to the Courts of Justice Committee, which it might have ended up there if it got out.
How did it get steered that way?
Well, typically the speaker will assign bills based on what section of the code they change. And so we have the transportation section is where these two bills were written to. So he sent them to the Transportation Committee. A lot of times what happens is once liability pops up, then, you know, we don't have as many lawyers in the General Assembly as we used to. And they tend to say, okay, if we want to move forward with this, we think
shocking
this is
claim.
Good. I know. If we think this is a good public policy, we may need to send it to the courts committee so they can think through what are some of the liability issues. And they just never got to this point. But I don't think that anyone should think this means they're never going to happen. I mean, oftentimes bills will be introduced for the first time. You know, in Virginia, we don't like doing anything new, so it may take a couple of years of people really thinking through it, right? and you know, maybe in the future, again, you know, 40 other states have passed some version of Doering, so they've figured out how to do it and make it clear. But I think it might just take another year, hopefully not two, but at least another year of really educating the committee members of here's how you can do it. Here's how our other states have done it, and it has made sense. Here are the benefits of it. You know, if you look in those states of what incidents of Doering there were before and after the bills passed, sometimes that helps. But I think that's sort of the bottom line.
Let me ask. I have two questions, I guess. Really, one for Michael. Did you guys look at bills elsewhere that had already passed? And then second, Jen, you're talking about, I guess you're creating, I forget how you put it, but basically you're worried that by creating something that has a finable offense, that if it's not clear as to why it would be finable or under what circumstances, with something like this, it seems like it already has a lack of clarity on the other side.
Right.
Again, there's that question, if I hit a door, I'm riding a bike or a motorcycle or my jet ski on the street for some reason with a mask on, then it's potentially my fault if I hit it. So doesn't that already exist?
Well, I think the difference is whether you're creating a new crime or you're creating something that you can be fined for, the state has certain due process concerns it has to meet so that the rules are clear. So that it's clear if you do X, you will get a fine or you will go to jail. And I think the concern here, and now granted, no, I'm trying to tell you what other people thought. So, but the concern they had was
hearsay, right?
Yeah, was this is a little too vague for our comfort. Now, I think, again, part of the problem you face is by the time a Senate bill comes over to the House, it's towards the end of session. People have a lot less time to really think through. If it had been a House bill coming through on the House side and they really had time to think through this, maybe in a longer session, but my guess is, and Michael was there, so he could probably, my guess is the bill was brought up in the committee. A bunch of questions were raised. People were like, well, we don't...
Table this.
Yeah, let's worry about this later. And they tabled it.
So maybe a short session was a good way to sort of introduce it and kind of get the ball rolling. So,
yeah.
Michael, back to you with the... And I'm sorry, we'll get to you in a minute over there. But presumably you did pattern some of this legislation, was patterned after bills and other laws in other states. How do they handle those concerns, and were they patterned after bills in other states?
Sure. So it's important for us, you know, whenever we ask for a bill to be patroned, that we do our due diligence on our end to see what else exists and kind of, you know, is this a universal vehicular safety issue, which, first of all, Doering is. There's nothing in that bill that said bike, bicycle, cyclist, anything like that. So we really said, hey, you know, it's universal vehicular safety, but guess who showed up to lobby for it? Just the cyclist. So it did clear the Senate, and when it came over to the House, it got assigned to House Transportation Subcommittee 2, which historically is known as the kiss of death for all bicycling. That's where bike bills go to die.
Oh, wow.
Namely because of Chairman Cox and also Delegate Garrett there, who did, you know, have a very intense questioning process about the bill.
Is it Delegate Kirk Cox or
John Cox?
John Cox, okay.
Who I've heard is not running next year.
He's retiring, right.
So that might be we'll see who replaces him, though.
And the other is, I'm sorry.
Delegate Garrett from the Lynchburg area.
Okay.
So the question that came up was, did revolve around enforceability and things of that nature. And we said, hey, look, you know, 40 other states have a version of Doering passed. And actually, you know, just to highlight that this isn't a left or a right issue, I used to at one point actually work at a gunsmith who moved to Alabama. And he said he was following all this. He bikes a lot. And he said, well, what's the law in Alabama? And I said, okay, well, let me look it up. Well, Alabama actually passed the unamended version of Doering, which had the you can't leave a door open for an unreasonable amount of time clause. That was what really tripped a lot of people up. They passed that version in 1980. So Alabama, deep southern state, in 1980, over 30 years ago, passed a stronger version of Doering. So I'm not sure what trips a lot of people up in Virginia here, but the other analogy we try to make too is this only affects
Alabama's a state, right?
Yeah, I guess we're in a commonwealth technically, so maybe things are different here. But basically, you know, if you are pulling out of a parallel parking space, you have a duty to check the travel lane and to make sure that travel lane is free of obstructions. And if you pull out and it's not and a collision occurs, it's your fault. And we say, hey, a door is no different. It's the same thing. Check the travel lane before you open the door. And actually in Senate subcommittee, in House Transportation Subcommittee 2, that issue came up. And I made that point. And actually a gentleman from the state police said, yes, it is enforceable. And you know, Delegate Garrett pressed him a bit and said, well, how is it enforceable? How would you enforce it? And he said, well, the same way we enforce any other thing. We'd come out, look at the scene, take some pictures, interview witnesses, and determine fault. So it's not, I don't know where the conception that cyclists or other objects or people like to run into open car doors, because that's certainly not the case. You know, if a door gets open in front of me, I'm going to do everything I can to avoid hitting
it. How do those YouTube videos get made otherwise?
Well, I'm not sure.
Well, and the one other point I would make, the fact that it got out of that subcommittee is significant, but unfortunately, when it was heard before the full committee, it died on a 7-7 vote with 7 delegates not there. And again, that's because when it was heard, it was towards the end of session. That's when House members have bills on the Senate side. Oftentimes, you're in the last, I think this might have been the last committee meeting.
So they're off lobbying, basically.
Well, they're off presenting their bills, or you might be needed for a quorum someplace else. So I think it was the last committee meeting of the year. Had any one of those 7 been there, if you look at where they were from, most of the delegates that voted against it were from areas where biking is not that big an issue, either very rural areas or more suburban. The ones who voted for it are in areas that were more urban, and the ones who were missing were from more urban areas. And so I think, you know, for everybody out there who got discouraged that it failed, you know, I do think if you keep with it, you know, next year might be the year, or, you know, heck, I had a bill that took 8 years to pass, but it passed in some version this year. So you just, you know, you may not always get it the first time, but just keep at it.
So now over to Tim. Hey, how you doing over there?
Fantastic.
So now up to the 10,000-foot view on this thing, while, yes, keep at it, we're hopefully going to eventually get something like this, there is something of a time, not limit necessarily, but a constraint on this. It sure would be nice to have a bike-friendly state by 2015.
Yeah, absolutely. And, I mean, we, in a lot of ways, and for a lot of reasons, we look at 2015 and the World Championships as a deadline of sorts. I mean, when we first set out to secure this event, you know, we always talked about this is much more than a bike race. This is an opportunity to be a catalyst for transformational change. And a lot of that, it's not all about cycling, but, you know, a lot of it is about cycling. And so it is important that the Richmond region, as well as the whole Commonwealth, you know, start to move the needle in that direction very aggressively. I mean, and it's...
Now, real quick, just to put it in context, 2015, in terms of economic impact on the state, or at least, I guess, the greater, much greater Metro Richmond region, what are you guys saying you're bringing to the table?
So we engaged...
What does cycling mean?
Well, from an economic impact standpoint, we actually had an economic impact study done by Chimura Economics, which is the same firm that the city and the state, and, you know, they're the most reputable firm around. They have estimated an economic impact in the Richmond region of about $130 million from this event. Statewide, it's about $158 million. This is, you know, according to most opinions and perspectives, this will be the biggest sporting event that's ever taken place in this area. You're talking about roughly, you know, somewhere north of 450,000 spectators on site over the course of 9 days. You're also talking about a television audience of somewhere in the neighborhood of 300 million people worldwide. So you think about the white hot spotlight that we will have on little old Richmond, Virginia. And I can say that because I'm a native, you know, is there's an enormous opportunity, and it would be an enormous missed opportunity if we weren't moving the needle in a positive direction as it relates to developing a cycling culture. Actually, I won't even say cycling, a bicycle culture.
And I would think that white hot spotlight is probably not going to simply be focused on the race. If you've got somebody like ESPN coming here, or even just the smaller affiliate stations that are covering something like this, they're looking for those sort of, I don't know, feature-y kind of stories.
Absolutely. There's, you know, human interest stories, community stories.
The local cycling community.
Yeah, there's all sorts of things. But you know, even beyond that, it's looking at the opportunity to leverage this event to create that bicycle culture and even create bicycle infrastructure, because, you know, there's a couple things to think about. One, from the local community standpoint, and local community can mean a lot of things, but, you know, we have a big health and wellness problem in this city, in this state, in this country. And cycling, you know, creating a cycling culture and a bicycle culture and infrastructure and all that can really go a long way to help that problem. If you build it, they will come sort of mentality. We hosted a bike valet at the folk festival this mm-hmm. past year.
Which was really cool. It was a kind of a neat idea. It was,
and it started out as an idea, and we had absolutely no idea what to expect. We didn't know if we were going to do this thing, and we were going to have five people show up.
What I saw was hugely popular.
We were overrun with people who rode their bikes to the folk festival. So there appears to be a pent-up demand for getting around by bike. And, you know, and part of it is because of the health and wellness issue we have, and more people are, you know, want to walk or ride their bike because they know it's better for them than sitting in a car. We also have a transportation issue in this country. The more people that ride bikes, the fewer cars there are on the road. And, you know, there are a lot of people that don't want to hear that, but it's reality. You know, the other part of this conversation is there's an enormous bicycle touring industry in this country.
And, you know, in fact, in this region, too.
And in this region. And the state lends itself very well to, from a geography and just, you know,
topography.
The beauty and topography and just the beauty of the state, it lends itself very well to that bicycle touring industry. And there, the demographic for people that do bicycle touring is a very high end demographic. They go places, they do these bike tours, and they spend a lot of money. And, you know, the more we can move the needle towards that bicycle-friendly state, the more economic impact there will be. And so there's a huge – if we don't do this, there's a huge missed opportunity for not just immediate but for the future.
Do we know the economic impact of that sort of touring industry now on the state?
Or? Yeah, you know what? I can't recall it off the top of my head, but there's
20 bucks, something like that.
Yeah, right. Add a couple of zeros to the end of that.
That's what I thought. I mean, you see them up and down 54 in Ashland, Hanover area, and Chesterfield is very popular. And I'm sorry, Michael, you were going to say.
I was going to say, just to build on that, I mean, this really is a statewide opportunity, because if you look at, say, for instance, down in Damascus, where the Creeper Trail is now, that small town, they said, no, we don't want cyclists. We don't want them. We don't want them. They used to put signs up along where the trail would be that said there's a wild bull to try to intimidate cyclists down there. It's really kind of crazy stuff. No, and you can, I mean, Google it. It's really, and now they've tasted the Kool-Aid and they love it because it brings so much economic impact and it fills their restaurants and their hotel rooms, and they just love when all the cyclists come through there. And that's what we really, I think, have an opportunity for is, you know, the guy like me or the guy like Tim, or we've already bought into it. You know, we already are big cyclists. We know what it's like. It's the people who are right on the cusp that we need to get there, who say, well, I'm not really comfortable necessarily riding on the street. You know, I need a path, or I need a bike lane, or I need, and that's the energy that we can help get towards with 2015, in addition to the legislative side of the house.
Right. And you talk about a trail like the Creeper Trail, you know, and cyclists are going there and filling up those restaurants and those hotels and those bike shops. But it's not just filling those up; it's encouraging people to open new ones specifically around the trail because there's so much demand. Mm-hmm. And you know, the next version of that is the Virginia Capital Trail that's being built between Williamsburg and Richmond, and that's going to be finished in the next 12 to 16 months. No, it will happen. you know, and that's the next great tourism asset, you know, in this region.
I would imagine 2015, you've got all these people coming here to watch bicycles. Some of them might own them. Yeah. Maybe combining their trip here with a little maybe history and maybe that trail.
Right, right. Well, and a lot of people that come to the World Champ, I mean, the World Championships is 9 days long. Some people will stay for the whole thing, but a lot of people will come for certain parts of it. And so they're going to be looking for other things to do while they're here. And so that's another great point is most of them are cycling enthusiasts. And the more bike-friendly the region and the state is, the more inclined they're going to be to, you know, take little side trips from Richmond and travel around the state, whether, you know, and possibly on their bikes and just experience some other areas. And so the more bike friendly we are, the more encouraged they're going to be to do that.
Perfect. And I've been with Tim Miller, who's the chief operating officer of Richmond 2015, Michael Gilbert, he's co-founder of Ride Richmond. They actively lobbied along with other groups during this last legislative session to work on a couple of bills that would have been pretty progressive bills. And then Delegate Jen McClellan, who represents Richmond and exactly one precinct in Henrico. And before we go, I did want to ask, Jen, you want to give us a quick wrap-up? How did you think the session went this year? Exciting stuff, right?
Sure. I mean, it was...
Highlights time.
It was not nearly as much fodder for the late-night TV shows as last year. It had its moments. We had a little bit of redistricting drama early on when the...
That was fodder.
Senate tried to... secretly redraw their districts. We had the two big issues that I'm happy to say we were able to move the ball forward on. One was on transportation funding, the first time in nearly 30 years when Virginia will make significant investments in its transportation infrastructure. And what I was pleased to see is that doesn't just mean roads, but there's for the first time ever, a dedicated source of revenue for intercity rail and a significant amount of money for transit. But there were some tax increases and fees that folks don't like in that bill as well. And then we reached a compromise on Medicaid expansion we will
Is that likely to make it over the last hurdle on the governor's desk?
I think so. We'll wait and see. But I think there was an effort to get him to at least agree to the compromise language, and I think he's done that. We will put together a Medicaid reform commission that will recommend some reforms that we should seek waivers from the federal government to give us more flexibility on how to run the program. And if that is approved, then we will expand Medicaid. And both of those compromises were reached sort of in the last 2 days of session.
Yes, they were.
And which apparently Congress was not paying attention to how to reach deals, because here we are on the eve of sequestration and they did not reach a deal. So they could learn a little bit from us.
Could still happen. Yeah. And education was another big one.
Education was a big issue. The governor had some K-12 reform proposals, some of which passed and some of which didn't. I had a bill that worked really hard on a bullying bill to put a definition of bullying in the code and try to help give the school some guidance on how to address bullying. And the Governor's School Safety Task Force endorsed that, because we've seen that bullying affects not just your performance, but can lead to some pretty violent behavior. Yeah. So that bill passed, not quite unanimously, but with heavy bipartisan support. Those were the big issues. Early on, there was a bill to lift the ban on uranium mining that went away, or the bill went away. The uranium mining ban is still there. We did pass
some. That one was interesting because the locality, I think it was the only locality that this really affected, basically kind of towards the very end, said we don't want it.
Well, that's right. Actually, it would have affected more than just the uranium deposit that's been found in Coles Hill is the one that would immediately be mined. But what people don't realize is if you lift the ban, you can have mining and milling anywhere in Virginia. There is a uranium deposit not far from the James River. And I think the bill was going to be narrowly drawn to just apply to Coles Hill, but in the end, there wasn't the will to do that. But the folks in Southwest Virginia and Southside did not want it. And I think the last big thing we did was we did put some steps in place to work on the state health exchange or the healthcare exchanges out of the Affordable Care Act. We are going to have a federal exchange, but we did give the State Corporation Commission some authority to do plan management so that they will have a role to help consumers navigate through that process.
And this was the option 2A of what the federal government allowed, which was either we handle it, you handle it, or we handle it with you helping to handle it, right?
Well, it's really they'll handle it, but they did give states flexibility to do some parts of plan management. The commission can review rates, and they will be able to handle complaints. If somebody has a problem with the exchange or with a provider, they can go to the state agency to address it rather than going in some black hole in Washington.
Got it. All right. And Jen, thanks for playing along on that
one.
And again, I'm with Delegate Jen McClellan, representing Richmond in exactly one precinct in Henrico. Michael Gilbert, co-founder of Ride Richmond, lobbying group that organized itself around three very important cycling bills this session, not just cycling, but bike safety primarily bills. And, of course, Tim Miller, he's chief operating officer with Richmond 2015 UCI Road World Championships, which is going to be a massive, massive collection of people and bicycles in Richmond coming up very soon. And money. Thank you guys for being with me today.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Alas, the end is nigh for yet another episode of Open Source RVA. It's March 1, 2013, first Friday for the city's art galleries. As always, or at least last I checked, I'm Chris Dovey. My co-hosts are Don Harrison and Amy Daniel. Our producers are Gabby Patsy Shatsy and Screamin' Jay Westerman. Mike McKenzie's wardrobe this week has been furnished by Casual Male Big and Tall Outlet.
Our board op may well be the lovely, talented Mannion. Thanks again for tuning in. While we're hard at work cobbling together another quality show for next week, go like us on Facebook. And remember to check out rvaopensource.com for breaking news, as well as podcasts of this and previous action-packed episodes. And hey, we love comments, questions, and news tips, so email us at opensourcerva@gmail.com. Till then, ciao.
Do the Muppets. The Muppets. The Muppets.
Yeah.